to chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A. American Express and Visa.
Well, that's the In Debt We Trust anthem here on News Dissector Radio, Media Channel Radio. And every week we do interviews with people in the media who write in the media, who make films, who contribute in some way. And today we're hoping that David Carr of the New York Times, who has agreed to be on the program, will actually turn up. It seems to be hard when people are working to get them at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, but we're trying, and I think we'll connect with him. He's a person of incredible integrity. I was up at Hunter College at the Roosevelt House just the last Monday night, and David was given the Aronson Award, named after one of the professors, former professors, and at Hunter, and also a former editor of the National Guardian newspaper. And he was given the award for his work, not only as a reporter, but as a newspaper columnist, someone of incredible power and status as an editor of the New York Times would tend to be. However, it's very difficult sometimes when you get these bookings for people to actually follow through when something comes up and they're not paying attention to the time and you are. So forgive me, we've been having these problems every week. I don't know exactly how to avoid them, but hopefully David will call in. He has our number. We have his number. We're trying to reach him right now. And when we do, we'll bring you in. Okay, so in the meantime, I'm going to talk a little bit about him, because what's interesting, in a way, in addition to his brilliant insights into media, and I found him much more forthcoming in person than he often is in his column, which is, after all, goes through the process of the New York Times editorial revisions and all the rest of it, and as a consequence, perhaps he has to be more careful about what he has to say. But in this case, he was very forthright about talking about the greatest form of censorship in the media. And he said it's self-censorship. It's when you don't cover something or don't pursue something because you're afraid of what the implications might be, or what the implications or repercussions might be. Even someone as powerful as David Carr at the New York Times has this worry in his head. And he told a story at this award ceremony up at Hunter about writing an article about two journalists in Gaza who were actually killed in the line of duty by Israelis. And he wrote this story, and he got a tremendous amount of backlash to it. You know, the Israeli military was saying, oh, they really weren't reporters. They were guerrillas. They were terrorists and all the rest of it. And he was discredited. He said for 4 days he was denounced throughout the internet as being a sort of a terrorist simp in some way, because he was reporting on the death of these two people. And I believe it was corroborated that they were journalists. But this is the sort of risk that one takes when you report on issues that are not popular, so to speak, or don't have validation in the eyes of people in power. And when you report on those things, what often happens is that you become the story. You become singled out as being a person with an agenda, or a person with a bias, or a person who has fudged the facts because of your own particular political or personal, cause that you're involved in. And often these charges and allegations are made with the intent of discrediting someone, and they often can discredit someone. It's an issue that is very common, you know, in the media, particularly as acrimonious as the media has become. It's almost like a battleground, a battlefield between competing ideologies. Fox on the one hand, MSNBC perhaps on the other, and maybe Amy Goodman on the other, which is, you know, kind of more of a left voice and a right voice. And of course, MSNBC is a Democratic voice in the middle. And, you know, and these people rarely agree on anything, and in fact spend a great deal of their time attacking the people they disagree with. And so we have a very kind of a poison pit of enmity and tension, which doesn't really help anybody understand anything, because everybody's trying to score points and put down the other person. And that's the problem, you know, that we face in our media sphere and trying to figure out what the truth is, because it seems as if big institutions have agendas as much as individuals might. And this is something that David Carr wrote about, and I hope to talk to him about it, but he wrote about Glenn Greenwald, for example. And he spoke about him as somebody who had been accused of being an activist. He said, in a refracted media world where information comes from everywhere, the line between two isms, journalism and activism, is becoming difficult to discern. As American news media have pulled back from international coverage, non-governmental organizations have filled in the gaps with on-the-scene reports and websites. State houses have lost reporters to those who used to provide accountability, so citizens have now turned to digital enterprises, some of which have clear partisan agendas. And of course, this is something that's very disturbing to the New York Times, which kind of embodies this whole notion of neutrality and objectivity and impartiality and all the rest of it, except when you look at it very closely, as critics often do, and find that it too has strayed away from the facts and into the areas of opinions, often fudging the two. And it's not clear, because in journalism, it's not only a problem of just give me the facts, ma'am. It's also what your perspective is, what your context is, what your background is. And that's what's missing in many instances. Forgive me while I try to avoid the danger of radio, which is popping, as we say, into the microphone. And I put a little mic guide on this. If you're watching, you can see it. But if you're not, maybe you can hear an improvement. So he wrote about Glenn Greenwald. And of course, when Glenn Greenwald began writing about Edward Snowden and the information that Edward Snowden had made available through leaks to various journalists, including Greenwald, Greenwald himself was attacked. Why shouldn't you be in jail? Was the question he was asked on Meet the Press, as if he had committed a crime. The assumption was not only that he committed a crime, but that he was guilty of that crime without any trial, of course, without any opportunity to defend himself. And that's what happens in the court of public opinion, where you're smeared often by people who don't want that information made widely available. In the case of Greenwald, of course, unlike many others who get smeared, he's an extremely tendentious arguer. He's a former litigator. He knows how to debate, and he's not shy about it. And sometimes it gets very acrimonious. And that's an issue that, you know, turns some people off, who prefer journalists to be people with no opinions whatsoever, you know, to just be neutral, you know, a kind of a empty-minded, as opposed to having a point of view about anything. And of course, Greenwald has become a target for people who have wanted to point to his role as being somehow not only dangerous but unpatriotic. And this has been a battle. So Greenwald has tried to fight back, as David Carr wrote. He says, as a journalist and activist, you know, which is what he called himself, he wrote back, he said, I have seen all sorts of so-called objective journalists who have all kinds of assumptions in every sentence they write. Rather than serve as an adversary of government, they want to bolster the credibility of those in power. This is a classic case of a certain kind of activism, he says. In other words, what he's arguing is that the people who are accusing him of taking sides actually have a side. They're just not clear. They're not willing to be open about it and explicit about their assumptions, their interests, and all the rest of it. So what they try to do is clothe, you know, their arguments in the mantle of truth, objectivity, above any, you know, ability of anyone to criticize them. And this is a problem. Carr says, interestingly enough, he says, "I take his point, but with a few caveats. Journalists are responsible for following the truth wherever it may guide them." Both the editor of The Guardian and Greenwald said they would quickly follow the Snowden story, even if it led to something that questioned his motives or diminished his credibility. "But I do think," writes Carr, "that activism, which is admittedly accompanied by the kind of determination that can prompt discovery, can also," he says, "impair vision. If an agenda is in play and momentum is at work, cracks may go unexplored." This is not to say that Greenwald's work is suspect, only that the tendentiousness, there's that word again, of ideology creates its own narrative. He has been everywhere on television taking on his critics, which seems, writes Carr, more like a campaign than a discussion of the story he covered. "Activists can and often do reveal the truth, but the primary objective remains winning the argument. That includes the argument about whether a reporter has to be politically and ideologically neutral to practice journalism." So that's the debate as framed by David Carr in one of his columns in the New York Times. And it's a debate that really is very rarely made explicit. It's just assumed in, you know, if you will, you know, in the battles, endless battles between Fox and its critics, or between MSNBC and its critics. You know, it's always the critic who has an agenda. It's never the person on the air who has an agenda. It's never the producers. It's never the people who actually frame the way the story is reported that somehow have a bias. It's always the person who is questioning their programming. And this is, you know, one of the problems we have in trying to get at the truth. That's why, hopefully, by doing the kinds of interviews MediaChannel.org is doing and discussing these issues in more detail, we can get at the various narratives that are being kind of in conflict with each other. Greenwald, you know, is somebody who, unfortunately, you know, becomes almost is forced to become defensive when he's being questioned. His integrity has been questioned. His motives are being questioned. The suggestion is made somehow that Snowden himself is working for China or working for Russia or working, you know, for the great infidel in the sky. It doesn't seem to matter. Anything can be said to discredit him and his motives, no matter what he says. You know, he was on a television program in Russia questioning Putin, Snowden was, you know, about freedom in Russia. Okay, I saw that as very brave, but no, his critics didn't. They said obviously this was a total setup. It was, you know, Putin was being thrown softball questions so that, you know, Snowden could stay in the country. In other words, there's always somebody who seems to have their own view of what someone's agenda is. And that's kind of scary, in my opinion, because Snowden, at least according to the people who know him, who I've spoken to at the ACLU and others, you know, say that he's a very sincere person. I'm reading a book now by Luke Harding, a reporter of The Guardian newspaper. And Luke Harding is now in the Ukraine reporting from there. He's a brilliant reporter, but he's written a book on Snowden. I think he wrote a book also on WikiLeaks. And he talks about Snowden's motivations and how Snowden himself became increasingly unhappy with the kind of big brother aspects of working at the NSA and its intrusiveness into everyone's life, its spying on Americans. You know, one point saying, you know, the NSA, America is spying on its citizens more than Russia is spying on its citizens. Not to say that all countries don't spy, but in this case, the United States has a pervasive, massive spy machine that's extremely well-funded, that's armed with the latest technology, that has the cooperation of all the telecom companies and all the internet providers, and has been able to create a way of turning what we have to say and do into data, metadata, which they then monitor and then decide if they want to pursue any of that to look more closely. Supposedly, they're not supposed to be able to spy on Americans, but according to documents that Snowden came up with, they are. And Harding, in his book, basically, he's British. You know, he doesn't seem to have a skin in the game, so to speak, to either Snowden or against him, but actually comes away very impressed with Snowden. Snowden actually is a supporter of Ron Paul and gave Ron Paul money, was a donor to Ron Paul. He's kind of a libertarian. He's not, on the far left by any means. He also has said repeatedly that he doesn't want to damage American intelligence, that he's not revealing state secrets, to try to give an advantage to an adversary of the United States. He himself speaks Chinese, is an expert on Chinese intelligence, Japanese intelligence. He has a global perspective and a global view. And at the same time, everything he does or says is put through, a screen. The screen of those who see him as a hero of freedom, see him as somebody who's a whistleblower and willing to speak up for everyone's rights, democratic rights, and the others who see him as a traitor, as somebody who is putting the United States at risk. Although recently I was at the New York Times, there was a big conference on leaks and intelligence, and Snowden, of course, was being discussed. He wasn't there, but Greenwald and Laura Poitras and Bart Gellman of the Washington Post were there on Skype to be part of this discussion. But so was a man named Robert Litt, who's a lawyer who works for the Director of National Intelligence, a spook, basically. And he was asked repeatedly, what evidence is there that any of the information that has been disclosed by Edward Snowden, a former employee of the CIA, of the NSA, and of these various contracting companies. What is the evidence that he has put America at risk, in danger? Can you give us some examples, cite some instances of why we should, want to put this guy in jail forever, okay? And Litt, basically mumbled and stumbled, couldn't really answer the question directly, didn't have an answer. So here, here's a situation where okay, well, I'm on the air now, so let's not have a conversation. Let's just have an interaction. I'm talking to the board here at the radio station, basically trying to pursue this. It's funny. I mean, I'm sure he will come on with me at one point. He agreed right away to do it. But, so at any rate, what I find is that it's very easy to judge someone. It's very easy to put them down without really understanding their motivations and his willingness to risk his life. He knows. He was asked point blank, what do you think is going to happen to you? And he says, nothing good was his answer, according to this book, Luke Harding's book on Snowden. Snowden, comes off as an extremely sincere, if shy, person who's a person of conscience, a person that Daniel Ellsberg, the whistleblower on the Pentagon Papers, identifies with and says he's just the way I was. Ellsberg was working for the U.S. military, was in the Vietnam War, was part of the side, so to speak, of American intervention in Vietnam that essentially he later exposed. And he was exposing a top secret history of the Vietnam War, which was commissioned by the U.S. government, which basically showed all the lies and deception that the government itself was promoting. And the government, in investigating it, decided to classify it at the highest level of classification so that Americans couldn't see it. And it was Ellsberg who brought it to everyone's attention. And Ellsberg has been one of Snowden's major supporters, as he was a supporter of Chelsea Manning, who was another soldier who actually you know, provided information about the U.S. role in Iraq, documents that would have never seen the sunlight had he not had the guts, in a sense, to make them available to the American people, and in his case, through WikiLeaks. But the point here is, how does the news media react to something like this? And part of it is a condemnation of the news media itself. After all, those are the people we're turning to. Those are the people we are expecting to actually reveal this information. And some are. I mean, the Pulitzer Prize for National for Service went this year to journalists, The Guardian, Bart Gellman of The Washington Post, who did expose the NSA. The Polk Awards went to Laura and Glenn, you know, who have done so much to bring, and Ewan McCaskill of The Guardian, who did so much to bring the Snowden revelations to the public. So there are people in the media who are covering all this. At the same time, there are people in the media who are, let's be honest, covering it up, not willing to cover the story, not willing to make information available to the American people. And so what does it take to do it? And I think it takes a personal motivation, personal values, a sense of responsibility, not just to yourself but and your career, but to the society. And that's what Snowden, you know, is an emblem of, if you will. And that's what other whistleblowers have represented, a willingness to speak truth to power, even if it came at a cost to their own careers and their lives. And this is something that you have to respect and you need to respect. David Carr, for example, one of the things about him that I didn't know, I guess everyone else did, but I didn't know, is that he had been a junkie. He had been a cocaine addict. And he was, as a result of that, somebody who had a big battle, was on welfare, living on welfare, Minneapolis, I believe, you know, on the edge of society. And at this award ceremony, he spoke about, in very personal terms, and he's written about this, and if you go and just Google David Carr, you can read some of his columns. One of them is about his daughters and about the drug-induced paranoia that he suffered from. And he was not a person he was, you know, later proud of, but he was somebody who was acting under the influence of addiction and of these drugs. And this is something that we often don't think about. What's the motivation? What's going on in the lives of journalists, on the one hand, and the people journalists write about? And he said that he finds a lot of arrogance in the press, the way it treats people who are poor and on the margins in our society and culture, in a condescending way, never thinking they have much to say or seeking out their views and their stories. And this is where it seems to me that Carr really separates himself from so many of the other media reporters who are into, you know, particularly in our culture, the Gawker approach, the listicle approach, the 10 top reasons why blah, blah is such and such, you know, the focus on stories like the stories of Mr. Sterling of the L.A. Clippers that got, you know, endless print and all the rest of it. And the stories of people who are suffering in our society, who are struggling with debt, struggling with all kinds of problems, often gets marginalized and treated, you know, sort of as if there's something wrong with them, as opposed to something wrong with our society and our culture. And so David Carr, who's not with me, and I'm not exactly thrilled by that, nevertheless, is a model for somebody who is not only extremely savvy and sophisticated about what's happening in the media, what's happening in the big media, who's able to write about it with a lot of insight and a lot of journalistic detail, but also somebody who has a story himself, and he's not unwilling to tell that story. That doesn't discredit him as a reporter. The Times published his story of his addiction and all the rest of it. He spoke about it openly at this award ceremony at Hunter College, and I was very impressed by that, because, you know, he didn't have to do that. And he speaks in a very in a manner that's so devoid of cliches, so devoid of even being predictable in terms of how he's going to put it and how he's going to phrase it and all the rest of it. And so I thought he was fascinating. I asked him, David, would you come on our program? He said, yes, of course. We've been back and forth on email. Here it is, the appointed hour. He's not here. But at least I was committed to sharing some of what he's about. And I think having his voice in the New York Times, and also it's a voice that speaks of the greater diversity in media today, the many different choices that we have, the many ways in which big media is being challenged by smaller media and digital media and all of that. That seems to me to make him somebody who's really quite willing to talk about this in personal and political terms, which is really what we need. I happen to be among those who believe media is the issue. It's always the issue. If a story's not in the media, it doesn't exist for most Americans. If a story is downplayed, basically and treated without any respect or detail, most Americans don't know about it and don't respond to it. So in that respect, Carr is able to do more than most media reporters have been able to do. He's not just interested in the CEO as a hero or the big company as the savior. Will Comcast come in and, save the cable television from... No, he's not one of those. He's one of the people who is out there trying to communicate with the public. Perhaps next week, if we can nail him down, he will come on and communicate directly with us. At this moment, we've tried and we haven't been able to reach him. This is just one of the problems of working in radio today, where radio's power has been diminished. Certainly this station, this network, doesn't have the clout of the big guys. But nevertheless, I think he's open to having a real discourse and discussion. And I hope that we'll be able next week to bring David Carr to you. But in the meantime, the issues he's raising, and as I researched and read his columns and met him in person last week, I came to respect him, even though I'm often very critical of the New York Times. I'm sure almost every host on this station is. But, you can't judge a book by its cover or the title of the publication they work for. He's somebody that came out of alternative media in Minneapolis and Washington, D.C., and came to the New York Times and has made, a name for himself because he retained his own personal values and his own personality, if you will. He didn't sort of try to conform with some boilerplate. And that's something that everybody who works in big media faces as a challenge. I certainly did when I worked for ABC News. And, I try to go off in a direction which was more consistent with my own values and beliefs. And sometimes I was reined in. But in other cases, I was able to do it. I always saw it as a way of getting away with something. But nevertheless, I think the Times recognizes David Carr's value and has him there as a columnist and as a reporter. His column is The Media Equation in the New York Times. Hopefully we'll have him with us again next week. I hope my little mini lecture here is of some interest as well. Thank you for listening. We'll be back in a few minutes to talk about net neutrality with Tim Carr of the organization Free Press.
Come all you good workers and all you dispossessed, the perps are not in prison, nobody has confessed. I say, which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on? Yeah, which side are you on, girl? Which side are you on? My daddy was a banker, but I'm not a banker's son, 'cause I refuse to profit from the pain of anyone. Yeah, which side are you on, boy? Which side
are you on? PRN.FM, bringing you new shows and fresh ideas every day. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Well, hello again. Danny Schechter, your news dissector, mediachannel.org, here to talk more about the media. And my guest today is somebody who's been very active in media reform, Tim Carr, the senior director of strategy at Free Press. He builds on Free Press's grassroots and policy work to advance the organization's strategic goals and reach new communities. Before joining Free Press, Tim served as an executive director of mediachannel.org, working with me, Vice President of Global Vision New Media, and a photojournalist for the Associated Press, Time, the New York Times, and Australia's Consolidated Press. Tim critiques, analyzes, and reports on media and media policy for the Huffington Post and on his personal blog, Media Citizen. Great to have you on, Tim Carr.
Hi, Danny. How are you?
Good. So we want to talk a little bit, if we can, about net neutrality and where things stand. There was a lot of steam being built up for net neutrality. A new director, a new head commissioner of the FCC came into power. The Obama administration, Obama himself, had spoken in favor of net neutrality, and suddenly there seems to be a change of policy in the works. Bring us up to speed on what's happening on the net neutrality front.
And you're right, Danny. Absolutely. The Obama and his administration had been very favorable towards net neutrality. In fact, when President Obama was just a candidate, he made it his lead media policy issue, spoke very eloquently about the importance of having an open internet. And he also pledged, once he was elected president, once he came into office, that he would appoint as his chair of the Federal Communications Commission someone who shared those views. And he's been through two chairs already. His first chair, Julius Genachowski, did a rather poor job of fulfilling that pledge. He put in place an open internet rule that was supposed to protect net neutrality that got thrown out by the courts. And now his new chair, a fellow by the name of Tom Wheeler, is taking another bite at the apple. And we learned last week from reports that were leaked in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times that the proposal that this, you know, supposed champion of net neutrality, the chair of the FCC, put forth, actually brings us the opposite of net neutrality. It allows for very powerful companies to prioritize their websites and services by paying extra fees to ISPs. The ISPs then give them a privileged position on the internet over smaller websites, smaller services, that can't afford these privilege fees. So this basically breaks the fundamental openness of the internet that internet users have come to know. In many ways, we take it for granted when we go online that we can choose where we want to go, what websites we go to, what services we go to, and that our internet service provider won't get in our way and won't say, well, you want to go visit your friend's blog, wouldn't you rather go to CNN.com? We'll make it easier for you to get there. So we're very concerned that this new chairman is not only breaking his pledge to Obama, but also undermining the basic openness of the internet.
Can you give us a little of his background, if you will? Because
sure.
when I saw that he comes from a corporate background, I didn't really expect very much of a public interest orientation.
Well, he has been the top lobbyist for the cable industry. He was the president of the National Cable and Telecommunications Association. He was also the top lobbyist for wireless carriers. He was the head of the CTIA, which is the trade group that lobbies in Washington on behalf of wireless companies. So he does have a very industry-friendly background. But he also was one of Obama's top fundraisers. And as is often the case, if you raise a lot of money for a candidate, and particularly a presidential candidate, once he gets into office, you can expect to get certain favors. And I think one of the favors was that he became appointed the chair of the FCC. Now, which isn't to say that he doesn't know a lot about communications policy. He has a long history. Unfortunately, that history has been one where he advocates on behalf of the industry and not so much on behalf of the public interest.
We know that there have been progressives on the FCC. One of them, Michael Copps, a lawyer, also, I guess, a former lobbyist, but also an advocate for the public interest on the FCC, was on our program just the last 2 weeks ago, last week, talking about his concerns about net neutrality. And he fears that net neutrality may be dead for good. Do you agree?
I think that's a legitimate concern. I mean, if we allow this chairman to push through his proposal and that proposal becomes the law of the internet, then we will not have net neutrality. What he is proposing is the opposite of that. So I am optimistic, because one of the good things about this issue, and a lot of people, when they hear net neutrality, their eyes might gloss over a little bit. It's a very wonky term about kind of the way the internet works, but surprisingly, my organization, Free Press, a lot of other organizations have been really successful at organizing millions and millions of people. People really care about protecting the open internet. I think they understand that in many ways it's the last bastion of free speech, and it's one of the last places where you can find truly alternative media, and that if we lose that, it will be a great loss, not only to communications in the United States, but to our society as well. So that we've been able to organize millions of people to pressure their members of Congress, to write letters to the FCC, to write, you know, letters to the editor of the local newspapers, to really create this kind of grassroots movement around protecting the open internet. So if, you know, our democracy works in that, you know, the decision makers take into account the opinions of the public at large, we should be able to reverse this plan at the FCC and return to some sort of policy that protects the open internet.
You know, in this respect, you know, in a sense, you are putting your hopes in the people. At the same time, it seems as if industry and, you know, people in power really are dominating our political system and neutralizing any things that could benefit the people. I mean, just the vote, you know, in Congress against raising the minimum wage, or any, not even progressive. I mean, this was like New Deal liberal kind of legislation was stopped in its tracks. And, you know, we're in a political situation where Washington, Congress, seems to be dominated by people who are either on the right or people who want to appease the people on the right, who are terrified of losing their jobs or losing their, you know, their positions. And the consequence is that there's a tremendous amount of reluctance to take on anything that people like you and I would want.
Well, you know, I'm not going to pretend that, you know, our system of governance is working well. In many ways, it's broken at the most fundamental level. We have allowed very wealthy interests, very wealthy corporations to dictate policy in Washington, and as you've noted from some of the issues that you've just talked about, it has resulted in policies that seem to go against the welfare of society at large. So they, you know, but the one thing that we have seen is that there has been a successful mobilization of people on a lot of issues. There are a lot of tools out there that people are now using to get more involved in giving feedback to their elected officials, and we need to continue to organize on those fronts to make sure that whenever these sorts of bad things happen, that we can create enough of a groundswell of protest to stop bad policies from happening. Now, you know, we've lost on a lot of issues. I'm talking about larger progressive movement, and certainly lost on a lot of issues over the last couple of years. And we've been disappointed, perhaps even by, you know, some of the people we put in office who campaigned on a progressive platform, but once in office didn't fulfill a lot of those pledges. I would include President Obama on that list.
What is your sense, if I can just break in for a second, what is your sense of what happens when an initiative that has a tremendous amount of popular support, like net neutrality, gets into the legislative process, gets into the machine in Washington? What happens to it?
Well, what we've witnessed, now what I've witnessed firsthand is that you find yourself lining up against a very powerful corporate lobby. You know, you can look at a similar issue in the media sphere that's happening right now is Comcast's effort to get its merger with Time Warner Cable approved. There was a news report just from yesterday that came out that said that Comcast had hired 76 lobbyists to lobby on behalf of this merger. Well, if you look at the public interest community and how many lobbyists we have, it's probably somewhere around 4 or 5, if we're lucky, working on that issue. But what Comcast doesn't have is the ability to organize outside of Washington. Their strategy has largely been a beltway strategy, which is to spend a lot of money on lobbyists and on political candidates on their campaigns and hope that inside the beltway that sort of influence peddling will yield them results. But what we've been focusing our efforts on is trying to organize outside of Washington in ways that will make those elected officials remember, you know, who they really work for.
I mean, you've sat in these meetings, you've sat in these hearings, okay? What goes through your mind when you hear really a litany of untruths being spoken, when you hear politicians wrapping their defense of corporate interests in public interest language? How do you react to this as a person? I mean, it must be difficult.
It's difficult, and I think, you know, I think the anger is apparent in a lot of people who work there, and I think the biggest fear is that we'll give up in frustration, that we will realize that the game is so rigged against the public interest that there is no hope in even trying. And so, yeah, I mean, the reaction is anger. I'm fortunate enough that, you know, we've built a very good organization. We have a lot of great allies that are working on these issues, that when somebody does come out and kind of try to spin the public or lie on issues, we do have some resources still at our disposal by which we can call these people out and hold their feet to the fire and let them know that lying in such a way is not okay and that we won't let them get away with it.
But when you go and talk to these members of Congress, you know, mano a mano, face to face, okay, what happens then? Do they sort of tell you stuff like, look, Tim, we know what you're saying. I'm personally very sympathetic to what you're saying. My daughter is a big internet user, and believe me, she's been telling me, Dad, don't do this. But you have to understand the realities here. If I don't go along with these people and don't, you know, endorse their proposal, I'm going to have some powerful political enemies who are going to try to unseat me. So I have to act in a pragmatic way. I mean, this is what I'm imagining the conversation is. I don't know if it ever gets to that level
of
honesty. If
members of Congress were only so frank in saying that, I mean, I think what you've portrayed there is probably what they're thinking. It's not in my experience.
It's like a Woody Allen movie with bubbles over people's
exactly,
heads.
Exactly.
What I really mean is, you know.
But the, yes, I mean, and you know, there are, you know, we have those sorts of frank conversations with their staffers sometimes who say, you know, this is what's happening and, you know, these are how many corporate lobbyists have come to talk about this issue and you're the only, you know, public interest person who's come and, you know, we realized that it's tough for you guys, you don't have the resources, but, you know, when we're hearing, you know, 10 times from these people about how we should destroy net neutrality and only, you know, you only have the resources to come up here once, you know, that makes a difference. And so, you know, the way that we're never going to be able to go mano a mano with the corporate lobby. We simply do not have those resources. You know, the types where we're a not-for-profit organization. We raise our money from individuals and foundations. Whereas, you know, a company like AT&T has billions and billions of dollars in annual profits that they can plow some of that back into their DC operation. And so it's never our expectation to be able to match them in terms of financial resources.
I don't know if you've read this recent or about this recent study that's coming out this fall about oligarchy in America. And it basically goes through 1,770 some odd legislative decisions and finds that the interests of business prevailed on every one of them. Okay, that public interest concerns were relegated to the back of the bus in almost every case.
And well, Yeah, I mean, yes, I haven't read the whole report. I've read about it, and I've read some of those conclusions. The issue really is that you not only need to organize the public sector to advocate for your issues, but you also need to find some allies in the private sector to be successful. And I think, you can look at a successful public interest campaign on communications policy. You can look at the efforts to defeat the SOPA and PIPA copyright bills that happened about 2 years ago. And the real reason that was successful is not only because millions of people took action, but you also had some pretty big corporations that were involved in that. Google was advocating against SOPA and PIPA. Wikipedia blacked out its website. There were a lot of tech companies that got involved in that. And I think that's true, that unless you have some financial interests, some corporate interests on the side of your issue, it's really, really difficult to win.
Well, is there corporate interest from the Googles or Apple or the computer people, the tech people, on net neutrality? Where
there
do
is,
they stand?
Google was involved when we were fighting this fight several years ago. Netflix, which has grown to be a pretty powerful company, has been very outspoken. But it takes a lot of work to organize these corporations to be advocates. They often are reluctant to weigh in on policy issues of this sort, but they're out there, and a lot of them are the sort of smaller tech companies, the kind of venture capital funded upstarts who don't want to have to deal with Comcast in order to get their new internet idea out on the internet. So they are very young at this game. They're somewhat inexperienced, but they're coming around, and they're starting to dedicate some of their resources to the fight.
I mean, progressive activists have been fighting on this issue of media concentration, for a long, long time. I know I've been part of it. Our mediachannel.org has supported that fight. We've had conferences, we've had meetings, we've had rallies, we've had some protests and all the rest of it. What's the scorecard today? Do you see more increases in media concentration? Do you think it's a losing fight?
I see more increases in concentration in some places. I think, back in 2003, 2004, when this was a really big issue and we were fighting then Chairman Michael Powell at the FCC on the issue of consolidation, the big boogeyman at that time was Clear Channel Communications, the radio colossus that owned about 1,200 stations. And they've kind of, some of these companies have broken up. Clear Channel is no longer, it's still a very powerful radio company, but it's no longer as large. And then, it's kind of moved on. Like, the sort of new face of consolidation is now what we see happening, what we saw happening with Comcast and NBC Universal. You're seeing broadcast companies and movie studios are now teaming up with internet companies to create this kind of new face of consolidated media. We've won a lot. We've won a few things. I think, we won legislation that opened up the airwaves to low power radio stations, which was a very important victory for us about 2 years ago. But we still have this problem. Sinclair Broadcast Group, for example, is a very powerful broadcast local television conglomerate that has acquired a lot of media outlets around the country and continues to grow. So it's not going away. Certainly, the problem of consolidation, in many ways it's changing a lot of its features. But yet,
at the same time, when we were starting all of that pressure, we had media and democracy congresses back in 1996. Okay, we were dealing with a different media world. A world of dominant networks, a world of big newspapers, and all the rest of it. Many of those newspapers are now struggling to exist themselves. Many of these networks are now splintered in many ways, don't have the same powerful focus that they once did. And many people, ordinary people, are now very media savvy. They're activists. They're online all the time. They live online. They're very, open, I would think, to the invitation to become part of this freedom media movement. I don't think we quite had that before. People didn't feel that they were able to to be players in the media world. Now, maybe thanks to Facebook or Instagram or whatever, people know how to manipulate technology. It's not just the people who are in at the top of the media pecking order that are important anymore. It seems to me that's a positive prospect for organizing.
And that's why we really need to win on this issue of net neutrality, because if you look at older media, if you look at the broadcast radio, broadcast television, cable television, all of those older types of media went through this process of consolidation to a point where they were dominated and are dominated by very few players. And the Internet really broke that mold in many ways because of the way the Internet works. It's a very flat structure where all of the intelligence and all of the choice making exists at the ends with the people who use the Internet. The basic idea of the Internet is you buy a connection from your cable company, your phone company, you pay them a monthly fee, and they basically get out of your way. So if you want to create a radio program and share your podcasts via the Internet, you could do that. If you wanted to read your news somewhere else and not read your local newspaper or watch CNN.com, you could find those outlets and assemble your own kind of media experience. And what's the problem we're facing right now is that this effort to destroy net neutrality would take away that kind of user choice that has made the Internet a tool that really empowers people to kind of, you know, navigate their own media experience.
You use the word intelligence. And, you know, this is something I've been very concerned about, how, you know, the agencies and organizations that we're signing privacy agreements with as consumers, you know, we're going to protect my privacy, are in turn behind our backs without telling us, signing deals with the NSA and intelligence agencies to give them access to our, quote, data and to give them access to what we think and what we say. And we, you know, we're in an environment where just, you know, I think today I read Snowden saying, you know, that America spies on more people than Russia, you know, that the basic complicity of a lot of these companies with the government is really shameful. How do you guys feel about that?
We're very concerned about that. You know, we have, in the United States at least, we have this idea of the First Amendment, but I think, you know, people assume that the First Amendment, that it means that we can speak freely wherever we are. And that's a false assumption when you're talking about the platforms that a lot of people speak on these days. We aren't, you know, going into public squares and putting a soapbox out and, you know, giving a political speech. We're actually going on to Facebook. We're going on to Twitter. We're using YouTube. We're using all these kind of social media platforms that when we sign up to use, we sign on to terms and conditions that basically say that they can block our communications for any or no reason whatsoever. So we are in this kind of exciting new era of speech where more people have access to the Internet and can use it to express themselves, but the danger is that the First Amendment really doesn't protect us in this space anymore. We are on corporate platforms, and it's kind of like trying to give a speech inside a private mall. You may think that you're in a public space, but the reality is that the mall guards can come and throw you out at any time.
You know, in fact, one of the things I also read today was that the TSA, the people who were, you know, kind of defend us at the airports, protect us by, you know, forcing us to get undressed before we can board a plane, have now been given the additional responsibility of stopping piracy in the media. Obviously, Hollywood has pressured, you know, the government to try to do more about piracy, and they've given that job to the TSA, which could become a much bigger police presence than it is today. That's another little danger to worry about, folks. Anyway, I just want to tell you that, you know, Free Press has been around for a long time. They've proven themselves as an advocate, you know, for change and an advocate to protect the public. Your website again, for those who want to, you know, see what you're doing, is, Tim?
It's freepress.net, and we also run a coalition website, savetheinternet.com.
So that's some ways you can get involved. I can't believe that anybody who is listening to this isn't concerned about this issue, that anybody who's listening to this doesn't want to do something to try to ensure freedom online and freedom in our society. And I think Free Press is a good place to be involved. I'm very, you know, pleased that you could join us, Tim. This is an issue that we're going to come back to. It's the central challenge now, trying to maintain freedom online and on the internet for all of us. And it's an issue that I hope you and others in your organization will come back on and talk about as new developments emerge. So thank you again.
Happy to do that, Danny. Thank you.
For being with us. Incidentally, to feed back to me, you can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. This interview with Tim Carr will be on mediachannel.org, and you can join us in it. Tim Carr, you know, is an activist with Free Press and is somebody who's very knowledgeable about these issues. I used to work with him, but I still support what he's doing now, and it's something that's extremely important. So please recognize your responsibility, your obligation, really, to not just take things for free, but recognize that there's a battleground here, that there's a fight for internet freedom that's underway, that there's a fight for freedom of information that's going on. That's the fight that Edward Snowden has become a symbol of, basically willing to take risks as a whistleblower to let us know what our government is doing and wants to hide from us. So all of these issues are challenging us to get involved, not just to read more and cluck, oh, isn't that terrible? Oh, my God, what's on television tonight? No, you got to try to take a little bit of a more proactive stance in all of this. So thank you. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector for MediaChannel.org.
Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, by a Coke, by a Ford, getting...